Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real. Five, four, three, two, and one. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards, and alongside me today, we have a Real Leaders Impact Award winning CEO. Please give a warm welcome to Miss Angelique Albert, CEO of Native Forward. Angelique, thanks for coming on the program today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Of course. So Native Forward, you know, providing scholarships to indigenous populations across the United States, 22,000 students now served over the years. I want to go back to some history, though. Tell me a little bit more about this company's story, this origin story, and how this all came to be a thing.
Well, we have a couple of founders that about 54 years ago had the concept of making sure that we provide access to higher education to Native scholars across the country from all tribes across the country. And so they partnered up, and really the biggest struggle was access to the financial means to be able to go to higher education. So they partnered up, started the organization, and had a focus of ensuring tribal sovereignty through higher education, and focused primarily on master's degrees, doctoral degrees, PhDs, and getting those kind of terminal degrees so that our people could be in positions of influence and be decision makers at the table. So that's kind of what our organization's start was, and started in very humble beginnings. I've heard stories about the founders being in a trailer house on the campus of UNM, of the University of New Mexico, and then going into their house and kind of having only four employees. And so that was kind of our humble beginning. And it started with a grant from a foundation. So that's kind of our start. And we were able to give out, you know, $500 scholarships and $1,000 scholarships. And we've had a lot of growth. And today, you know, we're able to give $30,000 scholarships and more, and just make sure that we're fulfilling the unmet need of what that scholar needs to be able to get that degree. So it's been 54 years in the making, and it's just an honor to be a part of it.
And just out of curiosity, like, what drove you to this organization?
I am a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes in Northwest Montana. I've always been passionate about serving tribal communities. And my background is very diverse. I didn't have kind of a linear path where when I was a child or going to college, I knew exactly what I wanted to be or do. That's not the case. I've had many different career fields. So I've been kind of a Head Start teacher. I've been an accountant. I've been in the tribal government field and business and philanthropy. And I've just taken every opportunity I can. And when I was in philanthropy, we were giving away lots of grants to organizations across the country. And it was then that I found my calling, because every time I would read through grants and be scoring them and awarding money, it sounds like that's fun, right? But I wanted to be the one doing it. I wanted to be the one doing the work. And I feel like that just aligned more to my spirit and who I am. It's just, I wanted to be the one doing the work and making the difference. So that's when I got into the nonprofit space and have just been there ever since. So I've done other things on the side, but that's all with the same purpose of impacting our tribal people, and creating access and economic mobility for our people, really. So, regardless of what I'm doing in the world, I feel like it's always aligned to making an impact.
I love that. And of course, as an Impact Award-winning organization, you had to fill out a few different things. One was asking you about the enlarged problem and your intention as an organization, how you're driving, or solving that solution as you continue to grow. It asks about your people, asks about your metrics, collaboration, and of course, your growth. I'm curious though, in terms of the enlarged problem, for folks who may be unaware about the situation among tribal people, what is like the likelihood of someone or having that access to go to college and afford college? Tell me about the enlarged problem.
Yeah, the enlarged problem. I think if we're going to tell the story, let's tell the origins of education for us as Native people. And our origins of education started as a assimilation policy. And it's nice to see so much awareness around the boarding school issue. You know, that is something that went from the 1800s until the 1970, really, and impacted my parents, my grandparents, and that was our first experience. This is what education is. And it's the children were taken away, put in boarding schools, which were just a residential center to assimilate. So with that being the first experience to education, I think that that informed our experience as Native people on what does education mean? But at the same time, with this organization started, 50 years ago, at the same time when these things were going on, and the founders had the foresight to think, maybe this is not a true education. So I think there, when you look at higher education for Native people, I think that's where it started. When you look at where we are today, we've done, I think it's important to be a good listener and to reach out to our communities and have them inform us to the challenges. And we do that continually. And I think that's what's informed us as to what that bigger issue is right now. And I could tell you, as an organization that gives out millions of dollars every year, we still only fund 18% of the students who apply. So there's a huge need. We've done research projects asking, our students what are their challenges? And they're having food insecurity, transportation issues, food sovereignty issues. So there are challenges, and it's those basic needs that are they're focused on. When you look at what does the typical Native student look like, it looks like someone who has they're looked at head of household and having to provide for their families and making on average about $30,000 a year. And when they want to go to college, the average unmet need is about $30,000 per year. So how do you support your family and go to school and feed your family? And so we're hearing from the communities that this is the number one kind of barrier to higher education is access to the finances. And so, as we develop as an organization, as we grow as an organization, of course, we have all these other programs and stuff that are important, but that the scholarships are always going to be the priority until we can fund more students, more than 18%. We have to get that number up. It's just we need to do better.
Right. I mean, higher education, of course, it's in the news. It's no secret, like how expensive it is, how expensive it's getting, and how it's impacting, and also the alternative solutions right now. There are people looking at other ways, trades, different ways to go into the workforce as opposed to college, just because it's getting so expensive. But you really touched on, a topic that I don't think a lot of listeners are familiar with. I think they would find a lot of value learning about. And that is the boarding school. And I think the way you phrased it up is ideal, assimilation. But that's a nice way of just kind of saying it. Would you maybe give some context to our audience about, what happened with boarding schools when you th when and how it's impacted the idea of higher education, with a predominantly, let's say, Christian-based, education program?
Yeah, so the boarding schools, during the boarding school era, all the children were taken away and were put in boarding schools that were institutions that were contracted by the federal government, and usually they were Catholic-based and run. And our hair was cut, not allowed to speak our language. We were given names that were different from our traditional names, and we were not able to practice any of our cultural ways. So, to give you an example, my grandfather, my mom's dad, he went into boarding school speaking fluent Salish and Kootenai, which are two different languages and very difficult. And to the day he died, he wouldn't speak them because of the severe abuse that he went through in that institution. So that impacted my ability to learn my language, and I had to learn it from other people in my community. So that's important to me to keep that piece alive. But also, when you go into a situation and go through abuse, and it's not just abuse. Not all children made it home. There are grave sites on many of the previous boarding school sites where they're kind of looking into that right now. It's an initiative being led by Secretary Deb Haaland, and looking into making sure that we document what happened, but also that we find those bodies of our children and send them home to their families where they belong. So, that can influence that, but also, when I think of the boarding schools, I think of Dr. Henrietta Mann, who is a dear friend. She received a presidential honor this last year from President Biden, but she's been an advocate in tribal higher education forever. And not forever, but she's been an advocate for tribal education. But when I listened to her, she said, that was not true education. And to recognize that is important. Because it's not about learning just math and skills, religious skills or whatever. It's about what does a true education look like, and what is the value of that education in making sure that our people advocate for that true education. And I think that's important because that was not education. It was not an educational system. And what I know from my education is transformative. So for me, I grew up on the reservation. I am the first in my family to get a college degree. And I have personally experienced, how transformative that education has been to me. And I see that, and I want to share that. It's also critically important if we as Native people want to have voice and want to have representation. And I think the most beautiful representation of that is Secretary Deb Haaland. For us, we were able to provide a small scholarship for her when she was going through law school. And then to see what these phenomenal, strong, passionate people do with that education, she is now in the very position, like that department, the Department of Interior, is the one that implemented the boarding school systems. And now she is in that position. So we know that a federal policy like that will never come out of her office. So to have someone like her in that position to ensure those type of policies are never implemented again, I think that's the power of education. That's the power right there of education, to be able to have our voices in spaces where it matters. So, it's a little bit about the boarding school, but I definitely encourage your listeners to kind of look into that, a little bit more.
Well, absolutely. Well, so much was lost, Right. So much was lost in our education system and how we were educated about the history of the United States of America. And so I just think it's really important. The thing I'm most curious about, because in my experience, little knowledge, but still more than I'd say most, I'm curious more so on the way of life of the indigenous population and what it's like on the reservations, and also like what that way of life you want to be now. Because as I understand it, there, you know, when we think about the different clans or tribes, right, they weren't all connected, and really until they had to fight against the United States Army, they were in their individual tribes, very decentralized, and it was like this, like the idea of government was just so foreign, like this idea of we have to all abide by this idea, this one rule of law, this, you know. So I'm just curious, Angelique, from your perspective, like what is the way of life for like your ancestors, and what you would advocate for to have a different immersive type of education? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, I think that, thank you for identifying that, you know, Native people in this country were not one entity. There are hundreds of 574 federally recognized tribes. There are over 60 state recognized tribes, and even more than that previously. And when you look at, we had different systems of being. We had our own political structures. We had our own way of governing our own people since time immemorial. And, you know, after the reservation eras, and, you know, we have, I think what I would say about living on the reservation, I think that there are some historical things that impacted the social and economic well-being of our people. But at the same time, being, you know, raised on a reservation, I will tell you, I am thankful to have the ancestral knowledge and the leadership. That's where I get my value system, is from having access to amazing tribal leaders who have always made decisions based on the values of our people. And the thing that strikes me about this real leaders is I feel like the rest of the world is finally catching up to our way of leadership. And, you know, and for me, I see my role models in leadership as someone that I aspire to be, someone I aspire to be like. So when I look at kind of leadership on the reservation, I look at, you know, alignment to our values, in that we value the relationships. Are very, you know, that's one of the value systems that's embraced around, and not just relationship to people, but relationship to our community, relationships to the earth, relationships to the animals and the plants, and we are, you know, as the original stewards of this country's land, you know, I think that there's a lot of knowledge and wealth that could be shared. And it just having that communal approach as well, and thinking more holistically instead of individualistically, I think that speaks to my kind of leadership. And I think that those are valuable. And to see those in play, you know, I think of when we were going through the reservation era, we had three chiefs at the time, and they advocated for retaining as much of our land base as possible, because that's, we're place-based people. That's our Mother Earth, you know? So I think that's one thing. When I think of, here's a good example. When our tribe was negotiating with the state on the highway that they were putting through, I think it took almost 20 years, it might be a little over 20 years, to come to an agreement with the state, because we advocated for animal crossings. So those are the tunnels that go under the highway, the bridges that go over for the deer, for all of the animals. And I think that that's important for us to use our voice for those animals. And when you come on when you go on the Flathead Reservation in Montana, you'll see there's a definite commitment to the environment into the earth, and it's just such a beautiful, pristine place because that's our value system is making sure that we take care of that. So it's nice to see real leaders as an organization reward people for more holistic kind of thinking, you know, thinking beyond the profit, you know, thinking about people, thinking about our environment. And I think to me, that aligns to my value system as a leader and what I've learned from living on the reservation and having access to those brilliant, brilliant leaders.
Well, it's very beautiful, and I am aware that the company, even seventh generation, right? They got the idea from tribal leaders who were thinking of making decisions not just for this first generation, but seven generations that followed. And of course, you know, we're trying to have far-sighted leaders to transform a short-sighted world. That's our mission. That's what we're trying to do. When it comes to like your experience, Angelique, like how do you tend to lead in your organization? Like, is there a clear example that comes to mind that, you know, you've come faced with a difficult decision where you had to think in a long-term perspective?
Well, I don't know about a difficult situation that has led to thinking in long term. I do think we always think long term because I am a small part of something that my predecessors laid a strong foundation, and I am building on that foundation so that someday, you know, others can come in and build on that. So I think it's being a part of that. But the way that I lead, I have had challenges in the way that I lead. And that's when, you know, it's important, diversity is important to us too. And then when we bring in people who maybe have different experiences or come from a corporate world and are used to a different type of leadership, I think that we've had to create norms here at the organization to make sure that people understand that we're a native-led organization, and as such, we handle our leadership issues collectively. So I was speaking to some of those values. You know, we think more collectively than individualistically. So as a leader, it is more collaborative. And it's a rare occasion that I come in and say, oh, this is the way we're going to do it. That's just not how we function. When we have challenges, we bring all of our leaders together and come up with the solutions collectively. So, and I think that's different than some environments. So that's been a challenge at different times here, but just having to document what does that mean? You know, that you function more like a tribal organization and having to clarify that for people and come up with a written norm around it. That was different for me, you know, but also as someone who has been engaged in other kind of other business structures, and I've seen the way that they have functioned, and I've always felt like a little bit of an outsider where I've seen people fighting to be heard. So I've been in meetings where a bunch of people are yelling, but no one's listening. And then I was told after that meeting that my silence was consensus. But yet perplexed as to how anybody heard anything. And so as a native-led organization, we do function in those tribal ways. And so we've had to actually solidify them and write them down and incorporate them as norms so that when we invite people to our circle to function in their roles here, they understand what that means. So that's been an interesting challenge in leadership for me, and just having to define what does that mean.
Well, certainly. I mean, it's a very collaborative approach. And in order to be a collaborative leader, you know, you have to be a great communicator because eventually someone does have to make a decision. Like the decision do have to be made. When you think about like the communication skills or style, like either you've had to learn or you've developed, like what does that communication style look like that leads toward an effective decision?
What I think it is having clear vision and a clear strategy. So I'm definitely a little bit more of a nerd when it comes to data and when it comes to strategy and making sure that's clearly outlined and getting the support of people who have more experience in that area. So, you know, coming in, that was one of the things that I did was have a clear vision, clear strategy of where we're going, clearly making sure everybody understands where we're going and how we're going to get there, having the roadmap to get there. So I think that's part of clear communication. And then, you know, when we were ready to scale up, you know, we solicited the help of Bridgespan and, you know, they brought us up another level higher to say, oh, well, you know, let's take my little strategy. And then let's just make it this massive strategy and make sure that every single employee who works here has that out and available and is working on that daily and making sure that we have systems in place so that we're reviewing that daily and weekly and attaining those goals. So everyone understands where the vision, where we're going and how we're going to get there and their role in doing that. So making sure there's alignment to that strategy and that there's systems in place. So that's been the most helpful is just having clear vision and then communicating that vision. And sometimes it's reiterating it. We visit it every 2 weeks at our staff meetings. And so making sure that the strategy is there, the plan is there, and that everybody's aware of it. So when it comes down to decision making, you know, we always go back to the students first, being in the center of all of our decisions. Mm. And our values, you know, are what drive our behavior. So going back to those values and then strategy, and it's just really alignment. So when we come back and we have problems, it's, you know, meeting as a team and discussing them and making sure that they're all lining up. They're all lining up to the mission, the vision, the values, and the strategy. And so it's a little bit nerdy and a little bit process oriented, but always with that passion and that focus on that scholar, that one scholar, that Deb Holland in the world, you know, that, you know, Rose Bear don't walk. We know our scholars. So that's one of the things that we do well is that, you know, we stay in touch with our students throughout the year and we have a whole staff that's their whole job is to stay connected to the students. So we know who they are. We think about them. We put them first. So they're always at the center of that. And then you have the little nerdy structure of what it means to be, how we're going to move the mountain. This is how we're going to, here's, that's where we're moving the mountain. And this is how we're going to move the mountain. So I think clearly communicating that is what I hope I do best.
Yeah. I mean, those are level five skills. I mean, building that alignment among, you know, all departments to execute the roadmap, to achieve the goal. I mean, you know, great, great advice and experience sharing here on the podcast today. Let's talk about the 18% of students who apply that actually receive the applications, right? You know, you're looking to get more funding for scholarships. How is that process going? Are you going through grants, donations? Have recent impact investors been involved through donor advised funds? Like, where are you trying to go on that roadmap to get the funding you need to support more of these students?
Well, I'll say that, you know, we do have federal funding, and I think that's important for people to understand that there are treaty obligations that the federal government has. Their treaty rights with tribes. So it's important that there is that contribution from the federal government. And so we do administer federal funds and that's important, but also partnerships have been a big part of what we do, whether that's through foundations, corporations, but also individuals. We have seen such an increase in individual donations over the past few years that have transformed our ability to serve our students and serve them better. So that has been a big part of our focus is really cultivating those individual relationships while also maintaining our strong partnerships with foundations and corporations. So, but it is nice to see just more awareness about us as tribal people and that commitment to really educating themselves and asking us to be at the table and asking us to partner. So that is a big part of what we're doing and what our focus is focusing with individuals.
And with so much going on, I mean, it seems you have both sides. You have the fundraising side, you've got the applicant side, the stewardship side, and then all the above. How, when you just said the word priority, like how do you prioritize your day? I just think it's a helpful question to ask to learn how other CEOs are prioritizing their days or weeks.
Well, I think that building on the history of the organization, I think that my predecessors did an amazing job with the program piece. So there's strong program systems in place. And so I don't have to focus on that. That's nice. We continue to grow that and strengthen that based on what the students want. However, that is, you know, something that we have a very strong foundation in is programming. And I'll tell you this, that shows in our numbers. When you look at graduation rates of, you know, we have for undergraduates, we've analyzed different programs and our undergraduate program produces a 69% graduation rate compared to 38 to 41% graduation rate for most natives in the country. And then the graduate program that we analyzed, we have a 95% graduation rate. So we know what we're doing is working. So my focus is primarily on marketing and fundraising and making sure that our organization kind of strengthens in that regard. So really looking at the organization as a whole, looking at, you know, what are our strengths, what are our weaknesses. So my focus and my day is mostly around fundraising, cultivation of those relationships, and then marketing. So people know who we are.
Right. Yeah. Awareness, getting the word out there. And just like curiosity, like recommendations now, just like best book that comes to mind that you've read, that you've been inspired by, that's helped you become a better leader, better business person, better effective, you know, delegate.
I think for me, it's not necessarily a book, but it's my education at my tribal college. So there's a number of books that I read. And I think if I were to recommend readings to people, it would be Federal Indian Law. That is the history of our people because of the relationships that tribes have with the federal government, sovereign nations within a nation. We function different than any other demographic because we have our own governing bodies that work directly with the federal government. And so if I were to recommend any reading, it would probably be Federal Indian Law. And they have different ones that are kind of in a nutshell, right? Or they're, you know, ones that you can kind of get a kind of a snapshot of those policies that impacted our people, because it wasn't just you know, the boarding school era, there was the reservation era, there's the Dawes Act, and there are certain laws in this country that really defined our history, and those policies impact us every day today. And the most recent thing that I read that was like, ooh, powerful, hard to read, is A Promise Kept. And this Mm-hmm. This is about the McCurt decision, which impacts everybody in this country, because that decision reestablished the reservation boundaries of about half of Oklahoma. So half of Oklahoma is now, they've reestablished those reservation boundaries to be what was promised. And that's a lot of Oklahoma. And so the country is kind of keeping an eye on how this impacts, you know, the rest of the states. And so it's an interesting read. It was difficult in the beginning. It's a hard read because there's, you know, the history of this country is not beautiful, but also, you know, the history of our tribal communities that were also impacted by things like slavery. It's not a pretty story, but also it's an important story. So you're going to get some current federal Indian law and some historic reading that's pretty powerful. So I guess I would recommend this one. And this was written by Robert J. Miller, who is, and Robbie Etheridge. But Robert Miller is one of our alum, and he is one of the leading experts on the McGirt case. So definitely recommend that.
Interesting. Well, we'll recommend him coming on the program if he wants to, you know, get his voice out there.
Brilliant. He's brilliant.
And so this is interesting too. Just another question I have for you, and maybe on the back of that question, it's just like mentor that have inspired you. You know, I think about this concept of there's no shortcuts in life. I think there are, and I think they're called mentors. And I think mentors really help us get to where we want to be faster. They're there for us when we need difficult questions or difficult conundrums solved. Thinking about mentors that you've had in your life, who comes to mind and how have they impacted you?
Gosh, there are so many people. I would say mentors are people who not just, they don't just offer advice, but also offer a hand up, right? So, and I hope that's what I'm doing as well in what I do. But I would say Jack Morjo, who was, and this is going to speak to my interesting past careers. I was a chief juvenile probation officer for my tribe, and he was my he was the department head for probation and parole. So he did the adult probation, and that man just changed my life and was an amazing leader. And I think that as a young person, sometimes we think our way is the right way, and he taught me that, you know, to value different people and their skill sets and what they bring to the table. But also Ron His Horse's Thunder, who's a tribal leader, and he's the one that he when someone reached out to him to be in philanthropy, he said, "I'm committed to my tribe, but I'm going to recommend someone else." And he recommended me. So just offering that leg up, I think that's important to create pathways for our people, or when if there's a door open to help lift others into those positions. So I think of those two people, but I also think of my peers, you know, who are mentors. Michael Smith, who is currently running the AmeriCorps program for President Biden. And you look at peers who, you know, he's younger than me, but has done so many phenomenal things in his life that I look at his leadership and learn from him every day. And yeah, I think that there's so many people. Obviously, Dr. Henrietta Mann, who is just the epitome of Native higher education for our people. Secretary Deb Haaland, wow, just, you know, I don't have a strong connection with Secretary Haaland. She's just a powerhouse. However, I watch her from a distance and admire her and see her strength and her continued connection to our cultural values and her humility and just that strength. I just admire her and look up to them quite a bit.
And it seems like, you know, there's things you probably are either working on or you exemplify yourself, you know, obviously to get in the position you are today. You know, you've learned, you know, under the wing of others and you know, served, you know, a ton, and still have a collaborative approach to things. Just like thinking back to like, you know, your younger self before you were in this position, what advice or experience would you share with that individual to help get them an understanding of how to get to where you are today?
I think one of the things that maybe that I would have definitely appreciated to know more about was the value of self-advocacy. And you can still maintain humility while self-advocating and asking for help, right? So I think that those things have served me well, you know, reaching out to people who are more experienced than me, and building a team around you of people who are more brilliant than you in different ways, right? So the value of I guess it took me a little while also to learn that value of people who bring a different perspective, and just how powerful that is to have those different voices at the table. So I think there's many, many things that I wish that I could teach my younger self. But self-advocacy is probably one of them. And then just the value of diversity at the table.
Yeah, that's a big one. Well, Angela, it's been a pleasure having you on the program today. Thank you so much for sharing your insights, your history, your knowledge of history, your experience, your leadership, all the above. And all of this, what's your definition of a real leader?
My definition of a real leader is someone who thinks beyond profit, someone who thinks holistically, someone who thinks about impact, thinks about giving back, and that thinks about the relationship, as I mentioned, you know, with my tribal values, that making that relationship a priority, the relationship with people, relationship with community, our relationship with the planet, and our other living beings here. So I think that for me, that's it. And then I would probably add on a little bit of not being afraid of change, to embrace change, and just just not to fear change.
Well said. It's a masterclass here on the Real Leaders podcast today. Angela, congratulations again on winning another Real Leaders Impact Award. Thank you so much for coming on the program. We'll see you at Real Leaders Unite. For Angelique Albert, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you to go out there, embrace change, and always keep it real. Thank you, Angelique.
Thank you.
Hey, Real Leaders, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to realleaders.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free, where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.